There's a way, a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 221. And this might be a little bit of a rough start because we've all been talking for about 30 minutes, but I neglected to hit the record button. So I apologize, and all of us will probably forget that we have or haven't said something that got recorded. But, hey, that's okay. I apologize. It's been about 100 episodes since I did this before, but it's not the first time I've made a mistake, and it's not the last time I'm going to make a mistake. With me today, I've got a terrific group of people. Andrea Janetta is the publisher of Fuel Cycle Week. Suzanne Hobbs Baker is the founder and director of Pop Atomic Studios and the director of the Nuclear Literacy Project. Gwyneth Cravens is the author of The Power to Save the World, The Truth About Nuclear Energy. Andrew Benson is a blogger who blogs at Adams for California. He's a 22-year-old son of a man who worked at San Onofre for 30 years, and he's decided to become a pro-nuclear activist in the land of the fruits and nuts. Steve Applin is a blogger at Canadian Energy Issues, lives in Ottawa, does a lot of activism in Ontario, and also is the keeper of the Carbon Per Unit Energy, CPIK, carbon per kilowatt hour. Say again?
Carbon intensity per kilowatt hour, CIPK.
CIPK, and often puts the rest of us to shame by pointing out how clean Ontario's electricity is. Let's see. Meredith Angwin is the terrific and dedicated blogger at Yes Vermont Yankee. And although the organ is warming up, somebody's clearing her throat, the lady who's not singing at the end of the show just yet, the plant remains open and still has an operating license, although the almost everybody has given up and says that the plant is essentially closed down, although it's still producing 620 important megawatts every day, all day, and all night. Did I forget anybody?
No.
Okay.
Did you mention Bill?
Oh, and I'm sorry. And Bill Kalogi? Kalogi. Bill Kalogi is a new guest on the Atomic Show. Everybody else you've heard at least once before if you're a regular listener, but Bill Kalogi is from California also. He lives near Diablo Canyon, 25 miles away, which is in some people's view within the evacuation zone. Not true at all, but that's the way some people look at it. And Bill is a nuclear advocate because he really likes the clean power that nuclear energy provides, and has formed a group to advocate for nuclear energy in his local area. And that's going to be the topic of today's discussion. How do we establish some of the act locally organizations that will at least somewhat be able to respond to the very organized opposition to nuclear energy? So I'll let each one of you say something so that people recognize your voice, and then we'll try to regain the conversation that was so wonderful. I mean, there was some amazing prose that you all have missed, those who were listening to this show and didn't get to hear the first 30 minutes of our discussion.
I'm Andrea Janetta. I'm the publisher of Fuel Cycle Week. It is a weekly publication that focuses on the global uranium market. The biggest local and grassroots campaign that I've been involved with is one with the epicenter in Southern Virginia, specifically Chatham, Virginia, where there's a big old deposit of uranium, and an effort to overturn a uranium mining ban in the Commonwealth of Virginia.
Yeah, the Commonwealth of Virginia that has 150 licensed coal mines and makes it illegal to mine uranium.
And besides that, a hugely, hugely vibrant nuclear industry, as well as the hugely vibrant nuclear navy, which has, as Broadwell knows, operated more small modular reactors, quote unquote, than anyone on the face of the planet.
Should I go next?
Yes.
I'm Andrew Benson, the blogger behind Atoms for California. You can find me on Twitter at @A_G_Benson. My local activism is pretty small. I haven't been in this game very long, but I try to reach out to anybody and everybody who lives in California.
Susie?
Hi, I'm Susie Hobbs-Baker, the founder of Atomic Studios and the director of the Nuclear Literacy Project. I live in South Carolina, so I do a lot of local advocacy in my home state. I've also done a lot of work nationally and internationally. And I, you know, I'm more of an educator than an activist, I think, at this point. I work with mostly women, young people, and minorities with regard to my outreach, and then I also work with nuclear professionals to get them trained on the most recent evidence-based communications methods and social science regarding successful transmission of information about science. So that's me.
Steve?
Hi, I'm Steve Applin. I publish Canadian Energy Issues up here in Ottawa, Canada. My activism consists of mainly conversations with people in green groups that I attend, almost all of which are anti-nuclear. Every once in a while, I'm pleasantly surprised that somebody has got some sort of carbon literacy. Bill was talking earlier about the carbon-free aspect of nuclear, which is what drew him into becoming a nuclear advocate. Every once in a while, I'm pleasantly surprised running into people like that. Not enough people know the numbers that we're talking about, the amount of carbon that is involved in making electricity, and especially the amount that is avoided when you're using a very high concentration source like nuclear. So my job is my self-appointed job up here is to get as many people knowing that as possible and to put nuclear on the agenda as a carbon-free form of power that can power society, and unlike some of the other carbon-free alternatives which cannot power society.
Meredith?
Well, I'm a little south and east of Steve, but not terribly far south. I'm in Vermont, and my blog is...
Yeah, you're not that far.
What?
Sorry, I said, yeah, you're not that far.
Yeah, my blog is Yes Vermont Yankee, and I've been blogging to give the pro-nuclear view, because most of the media sources around here are very happy to give the anti-nuclear view, and also organizing some activism along with Howard Schaefer. The two of us have done a lot of things, get a lot of people to come to public service board meetings, encourage letter writing, and even appear on the streets of Brattleboro when the opponents had a big rally, and therefore there were two rallies. Ours was one, and the opponents had another, and therefore instead of protesters appear on the streets of Brattleboro against Vermont Yankee, the newspapers had to say something like, groups in favor and against Vermont Yankee appeared on the streets of Brattleboro, and I consider that a huge victory.
Indeed.
And we do too.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think, Gwyneth, you're the one that I overlooked this round through.
Well, I go around speaking about nuclear power to different groups, and I've had some interesting experiences talking to women. There have been census takers who have gone out and, not census takers, but researchers who have been sent out courtesy of the nuclear industry, and they find that the percentage of women who oppose nuclear power is much bigger than the percentage of males who oppose. And mainly it has to do with what could happen to my children if something went wrong at the nuclear plant. And that has been a very interesting journey for me to listen to these women who are and their fears. And a lot of them did not know how many deaths per year are caused by coal-fired plants just from the emissions. Not, let's not talk about the coal miners or whatever, but just the illnesses caused by burning fossil fuels, mainly coal being the dirtiest of them. And when I've been able to share that kind of information and, you know, back it up with research from various organizations and universities and so on, women think differently about it. Another thing I should throw out here is, unlike the Northeast and California, which tend to be anti-nuclear, the Southeast is very pro-nuclear. The people who live around the plants work, many of them work for the plants, and their children are going to school not that far from the plants, and they're very proud of their safety records. And so there's and in the Southeast, after the furniture, you know, the various industries, like the furniture industry, went to China, these people could get jobs at the nuclear plants. And so there's a very positive attitude in these areas. So it's interesting to think about how to deal with different parts of the country and what the best approach is from place to place.
I want to chime in on that note and just point out that nuclear has the greatest gender gap of any political issue. Literally, it's the most gendered issue that exists. So,
more so,
so
than
as much as there are regional, differences, obviously, but there's a 30-point difference. Men support in the U.S. nuclear at about 72%, and for women, it's about 42%, with more than 50% actively opposing. So, this is fundamentally a battle of the sexes, if you will.
That's a good statistic. That's interesting. Hey, this is Bill. Can I say a little more, Rod?
Sure.
I don't know if I got into the recorded portion of the today's program, but my name is Bill Glogie, and I live in Orchid, California, and I started a group called Citizens for Green Nuclear Power. The way I started that is I looked in the newspaper and everywhere I could find letters or any kind of outspokenness about nuclear, and I got in touch with the people that wrote good pro-nuclear letters, and I tracked them down, and it was pretty hard sometimes to get their phone number or their email address, but I did that. That's how we really rounded up most of our group. So, and one other thing that we've done that's been very successful and rewarding is we've had talks before groups like civic clubs, like political clubs. We spoke to the radio club at Vandenberg Air Force Base. A lot of these groups are looking for speakers, and especially the retired people's groups, the Elks. There's just a whole lot of them out there, and they want speakers. So we've spoken before them, and we've reached several hundred people in a relatively short time. And we asked them to sign up if they want further information, and we've had good success with them signing up and getting information out to them. And now whether any of them will become energetic members of our group, I don't know, but that part of it has been very rewarding. Thanks, Rod. Back to you.
No problem. Hey, Bill, Meredith would probably want me to ask this. Do you serve brownies and cookies at your meetings?
We meet at a restaurant, and everybody orders something that they want, you know, for lunch or whatever. So that's taken care of. The Marie Callender's overlooking the Pacific Ocean. Very nice.
Very nice.
Yeah, I just received an invitation to one of your meetings, and I was very tempted, but I wasn't exactly sure how I'd get there.
Just let me know, and I'll give you all the directions you want. The meetings are in Pismo
Hey, it's
Beach.
Not a matter of not finding the place. I've got Google Maps. I can find anything. Okay.
We'll be looking for you.
Now, Susie, let's go back to this gender gap. I'd like to find out from experts, what can we do about it?
Well, I think when you realize that you have a specific demographic that doesn't support what you're doing, you've got to make an effort that is focused on that demographic, right? So I think acknowledging that that's a reality of the problem that we face, that, you know, that men are on board, we're good with the guys. And these numbers also do fall on racial lines as well. So minorities as well as women support at much lower numbers. So essentially, having worked on this for a number of years now, I think a lot of the distrust is sort of rooted in the fact that you, as a woman, I can speak for myself, so I'll use myself as an example. When I look at the nuclear sector, I don't see a whole lot of women there. So how do I, you know, build confidence and trust in something and an institution and an organization and an industry that I don't see myself in? So I think we've got to think about our diversity issues. This is a huge issue across the board. This isn't just a nuclear issue. This is in Silicon Valley. This is in D.C. This is pretty much any sort of powerful industry and the world at this point in time is under scrutiny for a lack of diversity. Nuclear is definitely one of those. And I think that specifically women, we know that, you know, radiation exposure is potentially the most harmful for pregnant women. So there's like really, really few ways that radiation could ever be harmful to a person or man-made radiation. You know, sunburn's bad for all of us. But with regard to man-made radiation, you know, we've got to look at kids and women, you know, the highest risk populations. And, of course, we all know the statistics. We know this isn't, like, a likelihood of something happening to these populations. But, like, you know, basically a lot of the social science suggests that safety messages kind of backfire. So the more that we're like, we're so safe, people get freaked out. They don't think we're safe. They think we're covering up or overcompensating for something. So what I found in my outreach is to be really frank. I sometimes wonder if the reason that there's so much support surrounding nuclear plants for nuclear is more than just the family effect, but is also the fact that they get briefed every year on evacuation plans, and they have iodine in their medicine cabinets. And so they get the risk part more in depth than any population. And so I think sort of the more that you focus on that, you can actually build trust instead of trying to convince everybody that it's like so safe, because it can come across as disingenuous and it can backfire. So yeah, those are some of my sort of findings just like through reading the social science and through getting out in my own community.
I've found that dealing with women's groups that aren't organizations having to do with energy or nuclear power or some other kind of power, just general women's groups that I've been asked to speak at, what surprises them are the risks and benefits if you compare fossil fuel energy with nuclear energy, and just the kind of facts about the fact that no one in the United States, no member of the public, has ever died as a result of the operation of a commercial nuclear reactor in the United States, whereas there's coal-fired plants, as I said earlier, automobile exhaust, all kinds of things like that. There's a high death toll, in health, public health problems, and these things make. I remember speaking to one group where a woman came up to me and she said, no one ever told me about coal before. People hear about, if the stove in the cafeteria of a nuclear plant catches fire or explodes or something, and this hasn't really happened, I just give this as an example, though, then people think that the nuclear plant should be shut down. It's horrible, it's terrifying, because something happened to the gas stove in the cafeteria. They don't think that when there's a gas explosion and people are killed. A natural gas pipe, San Bruno, California, a pipeline exploded a few years back. People just accept that. But if it's nuclear, they don't. And just bringing that to their attention seems to cause some thoughtfulness to occur.
And I would guess that as much as those facts are very compelling, that you being the messenger of those facts is perhaps even more important than the information itself. Because, Gwyneth, you're a very warm person, and you're a woman, so a woman speaking to a group of women, you're going to have a lot more leverage. And
that does help.
They're gonna trust you in a way that they might not trust someone from a different background.
That's true. But I also start out by explaining that I was opposed to nuclear power and protested the building of a nuclear plant in Long Island, and that why did I change my mind? And then I told a little story about that, and. One of the main reasons, there are two reasons for me personally: public health and the health of my beloved friends and relatives, and the public in general, and how fossil fuels endanger people all the time in regard to public health. And I happen to be a believer, or I'm convinced that global warming is happening. Methane clath rates are now thawing out on the floor of the Pacific Ocean, which have been predicted and now seems to be happening. Methane's being released from the ocean floor, and that's a more rapid release of very serious greenhouse gas, methane being the worst. Also released by natural gas, operations. So we have to think of our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren who are going to grow up in a world that's getting hotter and hotter with the oceans rising as more ice, as the polar ice caps melt and so on. So that's... another attack I take. I'm seriously concerned about the future of our, those near and dear us who are young or having babies now, and those babies are going to grow up to deal with.
This is Bill. I'm going to say something since there's a moment of silence. Thanks for the great idea about speaking to women's groups. I just wrote that on my notes here in big letters, that schedule talks before women's groups.
Well, it's more than that, Bill. You have to have women talking to women's
you
groups.
Have to have, and also
yeah.
You have to have chocolate.
And have chocolate.
Yes.
One of there the best.
Or cookies.
Yeah. I attended a thing in Westchester County, New York, where they had a chocolate fountain. And I had to speak about nuclear power. And the chocolate fountain, everyone was so ecstatic about the chocolate fountain that they were kind of high by the time I started talking. It was a great success.
So they
were ready to listen. They were ready to think about nuclear power. They were ready not to shut down the local, the Indian Point nuclear power plant anymore.
Must we get a
well,
speaker?
Science. Oh, I was going to say there's some science behind the chocolate and the cookies philosophy that I think all of the ladies on this call have leaned on that in the past to great success. But there's a study, a social science study out of Princeton called the Universal Dimensions of Social Cognition. And it looks at trust, which the nuclear sector traditionally has depended on these like self-ID'd surveys that, of course, everyone's like, yeah, I trust scientists. I don't trust activists or TV commercials or talking heads. Like, of course I trust scientists. But as it turns out, like really overestimating our own ability to judge. So these aren't very good ways of determining how people figure out who they trust. And what it actually boils down to is having the right mix of competence and warmth. So as you might guess, scientists tend to come in really high on the warmth axis of this paradigm, the competence axis of this paradigm, but they come in really low on the warmth axis of this paradigm, because as scientists and engineers, you're like literally trained to be non-biased, right? To be neutral. And we somehow like maybe got mixed up that like having a warm personality somehow like makes you biased, which isn't true. Obviously, you know, when I say it, it sounds ridiculous, but it somehow got mixed up. And so, really, these things is an act of warmth. It's an act of compassion that when coupled with competence, the public tends to receive that with a really high level of trust. When you have a lot of competence and you're lacking warmth, it kind of is like that mad scientist stereotype. People actually think like, man, this person's really smart and capable, but they lack humanity, and that scares me, because if they understand this technology and it's really dangerous, but they don't seem very warm, we perceive that as quite threatening. So I think that warmth component is maybe the takeaway from, you know, talking to women's groups. The success of bringing cookies and brownies maybe could better be summed up in an evidence-based way of saying, like, we got to be nicer. We've got to really be compassionate and show warmth if we want people to trust us and care about what we have to say. We
get a woman scientist to speak to the group, and she brings cookies.
Well,
you could just get someone, a pro-nuclear woman who knows what she's talking about, who brings cookies. I don't have a science background, but here I am, you know?
Well, so, and men can cultivate warmth as well, you know?
Yeah,
I think for women, maybe it's more built-in, but, you guys can cultivate that as well.
And I think that, and Susie, you can either tell me I'm just vain or what, but I think that I managed to cultivate that warmth when I spoke at a meeting that Susie was at, because I didn't wear a suit. I wore a t-shirt, and I had grown a beard and was not the suit, but I could still give and also I'm a grandfather, and I love my grandkids, and of course by being a grandfather means I was a father first. So I talk about some of those things as well. It is a disadvantage. I mean, it sometimes is hard for us who are maybe in the wrong demographic to be told that we really can't talk to women about why we want to support nuclear energy and why we believe it's the right thing for our children to do so.
Well, I think you can if you cultivate a high level of warmth. And then I think, like, when we're talking about local outreach initiatives and who you send to the forefront, for instance, with a women's group, that you might want to try to get a woman if you can. I don't think anyone's saying, like, men can't speak to women. I think that's a really that's taking it a little far. I think it's just helpful to think about, you know, like likes like. So it makes sense if you can, and from an organizational perspective, to try to match your speaker to your audience. But like in a one-on-one sort of situation, you know, just cultivating warmth, it doesn't even have to be talking about your kids or your family. It's more of an attitude. It's more, just tone, you know what I mean? It's right. More just your approach.
I'd like to say something that the opponents do a lot that we almost never do and we can do very easily, and that is the opponents try to have fun. You know, they have potlucks, and they have skits, and they have giant puppets. We don't need the giant puppets. But
costumes.
Costumes, yeah. We don't have to go completely overboard in this area, but having refreshments, having good quality refreshments, telling a joke, telling your own personal history of why you're doing this, as a, you know, these all bring both fun and warmth to it. And I really think that's important because, you know, even without wearing the suit, if we don't do some of these things, we're going to come across as suits.
Yes, I completely agree, Meredith.
There's another aspect, too, which is what I have observed growing up in New Mexico among nuclear people to an extent. The males in the nuclear world tend to be unwilling to talk about their job or nuclear power, or, I mean, Rip Anderson, the sort of protagonist of my book, Power to Save the World, I knew him for years before I knew what he did. And he was actually leading the team that got the waste isolation pilot plant in New Mexico open so that nuclear waste could be stored there. And I didn't know anything about that.
At least it could until Los Alamos goofed it up.
Pardon?
I said at least it could until Los Alamos goofed it up.
Oh, they goofed it up. But that's going to be taken care of. It had nothing to do with the waste isolation pilot plant, everything to do with kitty litter, the wrong kind of kitty litter to tamp down some waste containers in Los Alamos. But there's a kind of mysterious reluctance for people in the nuclear world to talk to those who are not in the nuclear business or in working at a nuclear laboratory or working at a nuclear plant and so on.
And so I personally believe it's been no accident that nuclear has been treated as a secret for so long. You know, that, of course, I grew up in the silent service. We didn't talk much, except I just was never very good at being silent. I've also been doing a lot of research. I'm right now in the middle of a book about the scientist movement immediately after the dropping of the atomic bombs, and the May Johnson bill, which preceded the Atomic Energy Act of 1946, and all of the discussion about how the U.S. had this secret that we had to keep from everybody. Of course, the scientists kept trying to say, well, it's no secret, it's just physics. But, you know, keeping people afraid to talk is one way of preventing people from starting to get comfortable with a topic. You know, nuclear energy is intimidating. It's a complex subject, and too many of our natural proponents have been stashed away in secret labs or nuclear power plant facilities, which are located in rural areas, and people can't talk much to their neighbors because they don't have very many. Well, they can talk to their neighbors, but they don't have very many neighbors to talk to.
But, you know, I have hope because I've gone to campuses where they have nuclear engineering departments, and you see these young people, and they're friendly, they're outgoing, they talk about stuff. They don't have that secrecy thing going. And the other thing I find is that at these campuses, there are a lot more women in the nuclear departments, specifically in health, like at Colorado State, the health physics section of the nuclear department. There are a lot of women. And so I think things are changing with more women going into the nuclear power world and just younger people who didn't grow up during the Cold War or during secrecy or during, you know, don't know much about atomic bombs because they just don't go off anymore, you know, that kind of thing. So there is some kind of natural transformation going on. It's maybe slow.
Well, I also like to think that the natural transition is that there are very few people left who have this original sin guilt associated with having participated in the development of the atomic bomb or working on Cold War bomb making.
I think also when I talk to people who, you know, are at Vermont Yankee, of course a lot of them come from the nuclear Navy, but a lot of them don't. And I think that the more diversity we have in the plant in terms of backgrounds, the better it will be for nuclear. Not anything against the people in the nuclear Navy, but it is, after all, called the silent service and so forth and so on. And so if you come in from, you know, a chemical plant or from being in the Coast Guard or from being in all kinds of different, you know, very responsible positions where you had to deal with big technical things, that's great because those people are probably a little more likely to be chatty about it all.
Well, one of the other challenges, of course, from the nuclear Navy being such a big input to it, particularly the leadership areas in the nuclear industry, is that up until just a couple of years ago, the nuclear submarine force was an all-male force by law. So a tremendous, there were a few nuclear-trained surface sailors, but not very many. You know, that large input, you know, you have this big wave of a purely male input, which has an effect on the demographics, and it also has an effect on having a bunch of people in leadership positions who, quite frankly, are not very comfortable working with women. And it's not, I don't know how to correct that other than time, because we finally now.
It reminds me of joining the Electric Power Research Institute in nuclear in the 80s. I came in from the renewable group, and there I was, you know, most of the people, a huge number of them, had come in from the nuclear Navy, and there I was wandering in from the renewables group and a woman to boot. So, yeah, there were some uncomfortable parts of that. People were very friendly to me. I don't want to imply that they were mean or something, but you could just sort of feel that they didn't think I was quite, how should I say, had the right stuff.
What a shame, it's much more interesting to work in an environment where there's where genders are where there's good gender representation. It's really boring to work around guys.
No doubt. I mean, I was never all that comfortable being in an all-male environment. Fortunately for me, I had an all-female environment at home.
Perfect.
Well, and there's some data that supports that really insightful thought, Rod, that you had about, you know, the Navy and how that creates a certain workplace culture in the nuclear sector. And I think that this, again, is like a broader issue in a lot of fields and not just nuclear, but that is with regard to women who get STEM degrees, who get STEM jobs, who make it through all of those obstacles that are sort of in place for women to succeed in those careers, that the number one reason women are leaving is workplace culture. So they, you know, they get over all these hurdles and they get in there and they just find that they don't fit in. So that's a real thing to think about and look at as, you know, we want to be more inclusive if we want more support and we want more participation in this industry. I think that's a real area that's worth some consideration.
I think it boils down, for me, it boils down to the idea of being welcoming. You want to welcome people into being nuclear supporters. You want to welcome people who are women. You want to welcome people who don't know very much about nuclear. I mean, I just felt that it was very difficult when I started, like, the Energy Education Project and so forth. There was no place for people who were pro-nuclear to get together, to join, to hear talks that were interesting to them. I mean, as a matter of fact, I'm in some ways surprised there are pro-nuclear activists at all, considering how extremely enticing the anti-nuclear groups can be. You know, they have a lot of meetings, they have a lot of rallies, they have a lot of skits and potlucks and bulletins and
it's fun,
et cetera, et cetera.
It's really fun, it sounds like. And you're really part of a community.
That's right.
And
that's
just as much about that. It's just as much about belonging and being a part of a community as it is anything else.
I would say in that crowd, in the anti-nuclear business, that's the overriding appeal to many of the people. Because don't forget, in my experience, the anti-nuclear people who I know, anti-nuclear is just part of the Venn diagram that they're involved in. They're in the protest movement. And they're in the protest movement. That's where all their friends come from. That's where all their social activity comes from.
Which makes it very hard for them to actually change their position.
Absolutely, because then you're betraying personal friendships if you do something like this. I know many people personally who I suspect that's what's holding it back. They've known people for years and years, and they socialize with these people, and they might consider it a personal betrayal. It's got nothing to do with whether radiation at this level kills somebody or endangers you. It's got nothing to do with that. It's got nothing to do with the physics or the science. It's got everything to do with the their social network.
They form loyalties to tribal beliefs. It's a loyalty to the tribal belief.
Yes.
You don't violate that.
So, right. Well, the loyalties to tribal beliefs. So one thing that is important to really, I think, acknowledge is that that's human. If you look at Dan Kahan's project, or Cultural Cognition, so there's an enormous amount of social science, but this is fundamentally human. So, like, it's really counterproductive to, like, get upset at people for valuing community and for subscribing to group beliefs, because that is built
into
people.
That's right, because a lot of the stuff is very honorable. A lot of it's loyalty, as Bill was just saying, loyalty to your friends. This is honorable. It's just... how do you deal with it?
It's
when
part
it's,
of human survival.
Well, I think
exactly.
that we can adopt those same values and,
oh, no,
and
for sure.
the same values. And that's what, instead of trying to, like, point fingers and tell people they're stupid and be antagonistic about the way that humanity sorts itself out and those kind of fundamental human needs of feeling like we belong and feeling like a sense of community, you start to antagonize against people's basic needs, and you're definitely not going to win them over. You just polarize the debate to a point where there's absolutely never going to be a solution. So you've actually, you know, damaged it beyond repair by behaving in that way. So I think what we can learn is how to cultivate those values, because nobody has ownership of those values. Those are up for grabs. We're allowed to care about our families and our communities and our environment too, and we do. And it's important to kind of build our cooperation around those shared values, versus like the science and the facts, you know, which I think tends to be more of the approach that the nuclear sector takes, which freaks people out.
And it doesn't work, as we, I think, have all experienced sort of firsthand. Like, oh, this doesn't work. Well, maybe we need to do something.
It entrenches.
I mean, I think being only fact-based doesn't work. I mean, you can't go in and say, hey, I know the facts and I'm about to tell you. But on the other hand, things like Gwyneth does, like what she says, let me tell you about the comparison between nuclear and what coal does. I think that can be helpful.
It can be, definitely.
I mean, and similarly, when the tritium business at Vermont Yankee, you know, and did a calculation, and you could point up to a exit sign and say, there's more tritium in that exit sign than leaked out of Vermont Yankee, and you can ship that exit sign through the mail. So, I mean, it's things like that are vivid, you know what I mean, that are vivid, that people can relate to, that you can have some understanding of changing people's opinions about the facts. But they won't change opinions about the facts unless you're warm and welcoming and you have something else than the facts going for you.
I agree, Meredith. I think that this building the sense of trust and building the sense of community is really literally building the transmission lines for the facts and for the information. If you're trying to scream the facts at someone with no transmission line, that information is not getting to them. So you have to first build a pathway for that information to be received, for sure.
How would you
but the facts matter. I don't mean to undermine the facts.
This is Bill. How would you build... Specifically, how would you build that in a talk? You go into a room, you've got 50 people from some group. How do you build that warmth, trust, transmission line before you hit them with the facts? Is that what you're saying to do?
Yeah. Well, I think the one thing to remember is that it's really counterproductive to try to like measure your success by like you're not going to win people over in one interaction, in one talk. Like, if you listen to Gwyneth's story, or if you listen to the story of anyone who's changed their mind about nuclear power, it's taken many, many, many interactions over long periods of time, and nobody, like, strong-armed them. They found their own path through these trusting relationships. And so I think, you know, just being present and available and focusing on building relationships and having a talk that's funny and warm and has some good information that might turn people on to wanting to learn more. But like this kind of like feeling that we can strong arm people in one talk from like going to neutral to being a full blown supporter. I think that you can set yourself up for negative interactions that way, because that's just really aggressive.
We're not defining the atmosphere, or we're left with this constraint that we have. We're invited to give a talk before a group, and we got one shot, and we can't have a form of ongoing relationship with these 50 people. We can ask them to get in touch with us if they want more information, which we do. But we're constrained too. We got this one opportunity, and we want to give them some facts, but. You know, I think I understand more.
Bill, I
want to say, first of all, that's a wonderful opportunity. Even if you can't set up, you know, a long-term relationship, that's where you're going to get the people who will eventually want a long-term relationship. My feeling is that instead of starting with the facts, you might start with your own personal story. That is why you've decided you've got to do this. And then you explain why I'm here, why I think it's worth my time to be talking to you, why I'm so dedicated to nuclear that I'm driving around the state giving these talks. And from there, you can talk about some of the facts. I think facts are important, but you have to put them in a personal context whenever you can. That's my feeling.
That's great. And you also have to start where people are.
Yes.
You can't start, on some other higher level talking about the AP1000 or small modular reactors. You have to start where people are, which is there's a dangerous building or this gigantic
industry
with these huge towers with radioactive smoke coming out of them. And I mean, that's what I used to think.
That's why I start with a pellet.
Yes. That is something I do, too. I hold up a little pellet. You know, they make these fake fuel pellets you can get. And you hold that up, and you say, this is contains the same amount of energy approximately as a ton of coal. And that gets people's attention.
And it's pretty disarming, too. Instead of those big things that they think of, now they're looking at this tiny pellet between your thumb and forefinger and saying, wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And then the footprint of nuclear power is much smaller than, from other power sources.
I like to ask people what they know about nuclear, and the weirder and scarier, the better, and then use something like, there's something called negative affirmation, where someone's like, because I do outreach around SRS in my community, and I work with kids, so some of the stuff that they come up with is, like, amazing, they're like, there's nuclear waste seeping all in our rivers and in our water. And I'm like, oh, man, there's nuclear waste everywhere. What are we going to do? And, it's fun to have fun with it. And that communicates in and of itself that it's not so scary. And negative affirmation, but by kind of getting into the scary stuff with people and saying, oh, yeah, that sounds terrifying. How is that happening? How is the waste getting into the water? Let's talk about it and let's dig into that. Kind of getting on their level, what Gwyneth said, start where people are, find out where they are, find out what they know, and start there and have fun with it and affirm what they know about it. Even if it's wrong, say, yeah, God, I would be terrified if I thought that was happening too. There are ways to still turn that negative into a positive interaction.
Thank you.
Somebody ought to make a fuel assembly out of chocolate. Like with chocolate tubes and the fuel pellets are individual charge. You disassemble the damn thing and you eat it.
No, wait a minute. That's exactly what Ted Rockwell used to say. All we need to do to make sure that people don't get hurt by nuclear waste is put up a sign, don't eat it. don't eat the used fuel rods and then you'll be okay. Hey, I think that I'm going to have to revisit this topic on another show because this is fascinating to me. There's lots of good ideas that I've heard. Haven't necessarily heard everyone speaking, but that's okay. This is a topic that has some passion in it and something that we can all think about. And how do we communicate our passion for this topic? I've been feeling my way down that path now for, I've been Atomic Rod on the internet since 1990. So that's also my neighborhood. That's another thing that I want to mention is that, in today's world, we have our communities, places we live, but we also have the communities that we belong to because of other interests that we're in. Do you all talk about what you do when you're in groups that have nothing to do with energy?
I try to bring it up every once in a while, but I also realize my friends probably don't want to hear about it all the time, so I try to selectively bring it up when the topic seems to call for it.
That's my strategy now, after having learned the hard way that alienating one's friends and family is perhaps not the best approach.
I rarely bring it up. Sometimes people bring it up with me because I write op-eds for the columns for the local paper every couple of months, and people will bring it up. But my feeling is that I don't need a lot of anger and confrontation in my life. I just try and continue to be a good person, and they read my op-ed, and maybe they'll want to discuss it with me. But I don't try and tell them, hey, did you see my op-ed? Don't you agree? You know, heaven's sake.
Well, that's not exactly, that wouldn't be exactly a winning strategy no matter what the topic was.
I know. I'm just saying that I just don't bring up what I do. People know, it's a small town in a way. People know, people read things, and I just try to be nice so they'll think well of me.
And by being nice and thinking well of you, they'll hopefully say, well, maybe this isn't such a scary thing after all. Mm-hmm. Meredith is that nice lady that lives down the street and every once in a while has cookies available for us.
Meredith, how come you've never brought cookies anytime I've seen you, huh? Where are my cookies?
If we're always in a big hotel somewhere, yeah. At an ANS meeting where I'm a long way from my kitchen. But maybe okay. I should be, next time I go to an ANS meeting, I should bake first.
I can testify that Meredith's kitchen is a very comfortable place to have a meal. It's I can also testify the same thing about Susie's kitchen and pizza night. Right?
This is Bill.
Yeah.
And actually, it was Susie's husband who's the pizza connoisseur.
Indeed. We like to cook.
And I like to eat, so I have lots of good friends that way. Yes, Bill.
Moving away from cookies for a moment, what about... Now, I heard you speak on the nuclear Navy mm-hmm. on a video. You were at a school or something in an auditorium, and that's the first time I ever thought about it, that the fact that the Navy is such a good example of the good use and the value of nuclear power. And now I started talking to guys in our group about this and others, and I didn't get overwhelming affirmation that that's a good way to approach and sell nuclear. They didn't say it wasn't. I just didn't get the same kind of reaction I got when I saw you speaking about it. What does everybody think about using that as an example of, you know, the Navy has opted for this wonderful power, and they've used it for 60 years, and they haven't had accidents and people dying of radiation. America should follow that intelligent lead of our U.S. Navy. Is that a way to sell this?
I find it persuasive, but I'm not the average member of the public, so I can't speak for them.
Yes, same for me, exactly.
There's the the military tie. So, like, yes. One of the big things that the nuclear energy sector has not fully wrangled with yet, I think we're still in the wrangling phase, is our weapons history and our military history, and that being, you know, sort of the source of a lot of our technology, source of a lot of our knowledge, that haunts us. And I think that, you know, the military applications of nuclear, yes, in subs, but then also bombs, which we still have and we still make. And so, I hear a lot of energy people say we have to, like, separate these two issues. We have to draw, like, a hard line and say energy is not weapons. But I kind of take the opposite approach. I talk about weapons a lot and dig into that history with kids in my community to try to get a handle on it, to try to understand that sometimes good things come out of slightly sinister parts of our history. Right. And even giving, like, other examples, like, space travel and things that we spend a lot of money on that maybe don't seem to have practical applications, but then we get a lot of useful technology out of it. And I talk about nuclear medicine and all of the discoveries that we've made and how those are actually deeply intertwined. Like at Oak Ridge, when they were making plutonium for the bombs, the people there on the ground really quickly realized that there were medical applications for that material. So, like, literally the dialogue as they're making weapons of plutonium was about how to use that material to help people. It is dichotomous, but yeah, the Navy kind of brings that up, which I think is maybe a good thing, but it's definitely not like a silver bullet of like, hey, look, this is so safe and perfect and awesome.
I think there's more grappling.
And when I talk about it, I try to emphasize some of the almost magical characteristics. For example, you know, when I talk about nuclear power plants on a submarine, I say, think about that. This power plant is operating inside a sealed building, sealed underwater building, but it's a sealed building. And that means there's nothing going out in the atmosphere. Isn't that pretty cool? Or I tell them, hey, you know, the fuel source on this submarine, you know, weighed a little bit more than what I weigh, and it lasted for 14 years. You know, imagine how beneficial that is to not have to move all that fuel around. Those are the kind of ways that I bring in, and not the military aspect. And, of course, I always have people that kind of push back and say, well, you guys use different – no. It's a steam plant, folks.
Well, but that's the whole starting where people are. Yeah. So if you ask people where they are, most of the time they're going to see the military connection. So that's why I would start there is in direct response versus telling people where you're at is wrong. Then you've immediately created a discord with your audience.
I think that's very important, Susie, that you're pointing out that you don't want to create discords with audience. I think we have to think a little bit more like politicians and to some extent be willing to hone our message to be the part of the message that we think that the audience will be most receptive to. I mean, it isn't like we pretend the rest of the message isn't there, but for example, if you are speaking to, you know, a Republican group, you might prefer to talk about the American jobs of a nuclear industry rather than global warming. I mean, maybe you'll talk about both, but what I'm trying to say is it's no sin to try to get a shared area, that is an area where you can agree on in order to help persuade people, as opposed to starting from wherever you think is the important thing and going with it.
Right. That's called interest-based bargaining. It's something you can buy books on. It's very well understood that
it's getting to yes and stuff. Yeah.
And I agree. And you also have to, like what you said, Meredith, like the thing that's in our control is our approach. The thing that's not in our control is, like, the public and where they're at with stuff and how they're going to react. Like, you know, I think we spend a lot of time talking about the public in negative terms, and that's, to me, a big problem. I don't think that resolves anything. I think it polarizes things. And
it's also self-defeating.
It's very self-defeating. And the thing we're in control of is our own methods. So, like, honing our skills, trying different approaches, reading from different areas of knowledge, because I mean, I a lot of my understanding comes from social science and then from like public affairs and resolving public conflicts, managing public conflicts. And so I read pretty far out from the nuclear debate to try to get insights into how to be more effective within communicating with people. And there's so much out there. I mean, there's an enormous amount of information out there that we can utilize, that we can dig into to be better communicators.
An angle on the military question I'd like to inject here, stepping back one phase in this discussion. I wrote a blog post a while ago about how energy and weapons have always been connected throughout human history. and perhaps this is a message that won't resonate with the public, but it's the way I look at it. In the very earliest days of human history, what source of energy did we use to power our warfare? We used biomass we lit on fire, biomass we ate to move our muscles and bash each other over the heads with sticks and stones. And as we've discovered, denser, more useful, more powerful, more cost-effective sources of energy are the energy we use in warfare has evolved, whether it's boiling hot oil, using biomass to dump on the heads of people, barbarians knocking down the gates, or Archimedes using solar energy to light Roman ships on fire, Mongols using horses to cover all of Eurasia with their ginormous hordes of horse archers, wind-powered ships. I mean, there's a steady progression of density of energy and energy sources used in warfare, and so it's simply inevitable that nuclear weapons are the strongest form of weapon, but also the most dense form of energy.
See, I think that's so valuable because this is what you're grappling with. There is actually the meat of the nuclear issue. This is what is at the heart. This is when you like let everything else fall away. Opposition to nuclear energy has very little to do with the technology and everything to do with this human struggle of how we choose to use resources. It has everything to do with, you know, the dichotomous nature of humanity, that we do use materials for good and then sometimes we use them for sinister reasons, and we always have. And this is a human problem, not a technology problem.
Right. I've always said that there's no technological solution to the nuclear weapons problem, only a moral, ethical, philosophical one. No amount of IAEA regulations or restrictions on civilian nuclear power or sanctions against Iran is going to stop humans from wanting to acquire nuclear weapons until we tackle the moral and ethical questions associated with our desires to harm each other.
Yep, bingo. I think that that's so insightful.
And they've been used twice, and we've had them for... How many wars have occurred since 1945, and how many wars have nuclear weapons been used in? There's a professor at Harvard who's published a book in which he alleges that the level of violence among humans, of course, is declining, and he claims to have statistical proof of this. And there's a lot of cause for hope, and I think that there's some gratification you can get from looking at the end of the Second World War till now, and you know this period in which we've had nuclear weapons, which a lot of states have had nuclear weapons, and there's been this issue of proliferation, and they've been used twice, and that was in Japan in August 1945.
If I could add a little more on the political science perspective to the decreasing war over time, what I learned from my international relations class is that when historians and political scientists do the statistical analysis of all the wars throughout human history, what we find is that the wars do not occur between democracies. If you have two democratic states with open institutions, free press, it's extremely rare to see wars again between two states of that sort. But there's still lots of wars between autocracies whether it's fascist or communist or theocratic. And you'll also see lots of wars where it's one democracy versus one autocracy. And so it's hard to actually notice a decline in the total number of wars unless you do a very rigorous statistical analysis that identifies the effect of increasing democratization reducing wars between democracies. And so once we reach some utopian future where everyone is a democracy, we may actually see an end to war eventually.
Yeah. Mind you, there's a little situation in Eastern Europe right now that's between two quasi-democracies, you could call them.
Right.
But,
really? Which quasi-democracies are you referring to? Russia
Ukraine
and Ukraine?
Russia?
Hey, guys. I've got an early meeting, so I apologize if I'm not going
right.
to start
and I was
a political
just,
debate at this hour.
Nah, I think it's time to end this call. I thank you all for your participation. We'll talk more about this issue as time goes on. Thank you all for participating at this late hour. And you can all say goodbye.
Yeah. Thanks, Rod.
Thank you, Rod.
Thanks, Rod. Thanks for all the ideas for our group to get out there and communicate with people. This is Bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill, for joining. I'm happy to have met you. Bye.
Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
There's a way is such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adam's way.